Hello and welcome back to Empire's podcast, The Ottomans. I am Frank, your creator and host. I'd like to let everyone know that the podcast does have an official YouTube channel. Don't worry, it's not simply rehashed content thrown up. I've created short videos on all subjects touching upon the Ottoman Empire. For instance, did you know that the Ottoman Empire stepped in and helped out the Irish during the Great Famine? I find the channel to be a fun extension of this podcast. For those of you that are hanging around on Instagram, you can find me there as well, at Sublime Ottoman Insta, all one word, again, that Sublime Ottoman Insta. And if you'd like to offer corrections to any episode, and believe me, I'm by far not an expert, so any fair, rational, and respectful criticism is always welcome. Or to get any thoughts off your chest, anything that you'd like, please feel free to shoot me an email at empiresofhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Before jumping in, I'd like to take some time and read to you a review that was just published on Apple Podcast by 3-star Joe. Sometimes you discover audio gold out there, and this is one of those podcasts. Frank does an amazing job painting a picture of a bygone era, but you might as well be there. Check the show out. Well, what can I say, 3-star Joe, other than a gigantic thank you from the very bottom of my heart. 5-star reviews left by my listeners and your wonderful emails. Guys, this is really what keeps me going. Also, if you've left a review and I haven't read it out loud, it's probably because reviews published outside the United States are kind of hard for me to see. So if I could ask you, please take a screenshot and shoot me an email. And now let's jump right into the episode. And please remember to stay tuned to the end of this show for some show notes and news of what's coming down the road. Pacifying Anatolia, Second Siege of Thessalonica, Setting the Stage for the Crusade of Varna, Episode 19. First, I'd like to apologize in advance because I have a feeling that this episode is going to be a bit longer than normal. Hopefully not too much, because the last thing I want to do is bore anyone. But truth be told, we're going to be getting into a very well-trodden ground as far as primary source material goes, up to and especially after the Crusade of Varna. And laying out the groundwork is absolutely essential if we are to understand why the Ottoman leadership made the decisions that they made. I threw around the idea of making this a two-parter, releasing it on Tuesday, the day that you're listening to it, and maybe coming out with it Thursday. But I've decided I'm just going to lump these two parts together, and on we're going to go. Now, with that disclaimer out of the way, we left Sultan Murad II off in episode 18, after he had successfully beat off attempts by the Byzantine Emperor Manuel II to upset the Ottoman dynasty by releasing pretenders into the realm to cause havoc. If you'll recall, havoc did ensue, but everything ended with Murad coming out on top. So this will put us at roughly the end of 1424, and Murad took a breather in Bursa, as getting up to Edirne was as yet a little bit too risky for our young sultan. In the winter of 1425, the sultan took a look at the strategic situation facing his new empire. As my listeners are no doubt familiar with how I analyze things, let's take a look at the vulnerabilities facing Murad. First and foremost were the Anatolian Beys. After the defeat of Kuchuk, the Ottoman pretender sent by Byzantine, the Beyliks were happy to see Murad and the pretender war things out between themselves, and thereby purchase a little bit more independence in the meantime. But when Murad came out on top, and in as little time as he did, they were now seriously beginning to rethink their position. Four prominent beyliks, led by, you guessed it, the Carmenids, had sent diplomatic overtures to Venice, the Genoese, Rome, and Hungary. Although they were careful to avoid the optics of Muslims, siding with Christians against their fellow Muslims, they phrased things very carefully indeed. After looking at some of the diplomatic exchanges, and really what I mean here are the letters sent here and there between third parties, the conversations between the Anatolian Beys and the Christian powers went something like this. Hey, us Anatolian Beys, we don't like the Ottomans, and you certainly don't like the Ottomans. But since they're fellow Muslims, we can't openly declare an alliance for Venice or Hungary, or, Lord forbid, join a crusade against them. But if you Christian powers were to, invade the Ottoman Balkans, why, wouldn't it be funny if we just happened to attack them in Anatolia at exactly the same time? Funny how that would work out, wouldn't it? Another factor, and that was the Carmenids, were growing in power. After the reemergence of a successor to Tamerlane in Persia, the Carmenid Bey was cutting deals with the Mamluks of Egypt to his south, left, and right, and he was constantly agitating the Beys to rise up against the Ottoman dynasty. The second vulnerability faced by Murad was a thorny issue of succession. With the horror of the Ottoman civil wars after the defeat of Bayezid, which I covered in The Ottoman Interregnum, episode 13, there was serious talk amongst the Islamic scholars about how best do we avoid such infighting and bloodshed in the future. It wasn't so much the bloodshed that upset them, but the power brokers in the economic and religious world that was the Ottoman sphere. They wanted order above all, order to conduct trade and business, in order to establish religious schools, courts, academics. And without stability, the vital cog in this machine, the Islamic charities, which even today are mighty and powerful, couldn't thrive and pay for everything. It had seemed like every single sultan had either gotten lucky, as in the case of Oran and Murad I, or now had come out on top of a bloody, two men enter, one man leave Thunderdome kind of situation. Turkish tradition seemed to not frown upon civil wars, so it wasn't a big help. After all, God picks the winner. But the Ottoman state was now large, in all caps. It was complicated, but in so many other ways, extremely fragile. There was growing talk now amongst the Ottoman statesmen and religious scholars on what exactly could be done to prevent such messiness in the future. From all this talk, gradually under Murad II, and then eventually solidified under his son and future sultan, Mehmed II, emerged what we call the Iron Law of Fratricide, whereby when a new sultan was proclaimed by his father, upon said father's death, that son would automatically become the sultan and all the living male relatives of the House of Ottoman that the empire could get its hands on would be put to death. That way, there'd be just one guy to head the House of Ottoman. Problem solved. I bring this up and place it under the vulnerability portion of our T-chart because the question of who would succeed not only Murad II, but every single sultan thereafter would become an unstabilizing variable and one that really wouldn't get itself sorted out until the 1700s. Third, were the Christian powers to the empire's geographic west. The Civil War period had brought to Europe a reprieve from the meat grinder of Christendom that was the Ottoman Empire. Even Byzantine had managed to cobble some land here and there and better provide security for the city of Constantinople. However, with Murad II's defeat of Kachuk, the Christian powers were now sitting up and getting worried. Things were looking like, for the first time in over 25 years, that the Ottoman Empire was going to start turning outside of itself and once more become the threat it had under Bayezid. One continuing problem facing the Christian West was that each dukedom, kingdom, or petty empire were faced by both their internal issues and conflicting realms of interest outside their borders. However, by 1424, things looked to be aligning finally for the West. Venice had interests in the Eastern Mediterranean, with its various trading posts and colonies spread out and connected via their naval supremacy. Although in competition with the Genoese, they were now working closely together to ferry Byzantine troops here and there in an effort to weaken the Ottomans. The Byzantines, ever masters of diplomacy and intrigue, were constantly spreading bribes around, rumors, sharing intelligence on Ottoman movements, and the emperor was screaming at the tops of his lungs for anyone to hear him that another crusade was needed to check future Ottoman advances. Hungary, a major power up in the Balkans, had enjoyed the benefit of one competent king after another, and I promised to jump more into the subject of those competent kings, generals, and leaders. But suffice it to say for now that Hungary had institutional memories dating back to the Crusade of Nicopolis and had been smarting for a second go at the Ottomans ever since. Not just that, but the King of Hungary could field massive armies, the kind of formations that if the main Ottoman contingent in the Balkans broke, they could see their gains all rolled back. Wallachia, directly north of Bulgaria, had been brought in as an Ottoman vassal by Mehmed, yet they had managed to shake off the Ottomans while Murad was fighting the pretenders. Along with the despot of Serbia, who was something of a local strongman, it looked like the two countries would fully throw off the Ottoman yoke, and soon if a dedicated campaign wasn't launched to reestablish Ottoman control. To complicate matters, the further the Ottomans pushed into Europe, the more of a strategic threat they were perceived by Hungary, Poland, the Holy Roman Empire, and the burgeoning Russian state further north. This would become a reoccurring theme moving forward into Murad II's son's reign, Mehmed II, and his future campaigns into the Balkans. But all of that and their strategic analysis for later episodes. At this point, the major powers, Hungary, Rome, Byzantine, and Poland, were all looking at Serbia and Wallachia as a good place to stop the Ottomans. And, much like the Crusade of Nicopolis, internationally, the Ottomans seemed isolated, with no friends, and their armies untested and unready. Now that I've covered these three central vulnerabilities of the Ottoman strategic position, it's now time to pivot, and let's talk about four distinct advantages Murad II enjoyed in 1424. First, you could say that the Anatolian Beys were disloyal, independent-minded, and always chancing for any opportunity to peel away from the Ottomans, but at the same time, they were disloyal and independently minded. And by this I mean to say that they were disloyal to each other, to great powers like the Mamluks, who were quickly coming to regret their hasty alliance with the fickle Karmanid state, and their very independent traits seemed to prevent any sort of long-term alliance amongst themselves. This meant that the old Ottoman policy of showering favor here, wrath there, and then dividing up and conquering each beylik was a viable option for Murad. Sure, there was always a present danger of the Ottoman army becoming tied up in Rumelia, but even if the Beys launched attacks to take advantage of this, how much of a gain could they really pull off? Each bey could only draw on his own teeny sliver of land for men and material, with the exception of the Karmanids, and this meant that a long-term, manpower-intensive, logistically hungry operation that that would be needed to tackle the Ottomans simply wasn't within their grasp. Second was the growing core of professional soldiers the Sultan could muster. First and foremost, the Janissaries, Sapihas, but also a multitude of technical soldiers specializing in cannons, foundry, armory, logistics, assaults, and sieges. Not to mention the countless, numerous, multiple hordes of warlord Ghazis and wandering Islamic soldiers of fortunes. Not only that, but the Ottomans enjoyed what we today would call a general staff, a full-time, dedicated men who would wear the ranks of Pasha, Vizier, and Orta, who composed the true leadership of the Ottoman military, men of intelligence and ambition. This core of leadership was provided by formerly Christian families whom had converted to Islam under Sultan Murad I and came predominantly from the Balkans. Men with no ties to Anatolia and who owed their entire allegiance to the House of Ottoman. In between campaigns, this hardcore group of officers would often meet to discuss, hey, what went wrong, what went right, and what can we do next time concerning the previous campaign. They would collect intelligence and build networks and generally improve the absolute efficiency of the Ottoman military's training, logistics, planning, and operational abilities. This sharpening of the lance, so to speak, would put into Murad II's hands and later his son Mehmed a tool of warfare not seen since the legions of ancient Rome. So yes, we can definitely count his army in his prose kit. Third was the sheer amount of resources the Sultan could bring to bear upon any problem. From the Western holdings in Europe would come men and taxes. From the East, yet more men, primarily cavalry, administrators, and political and religious clout. After his father Mehmed had wrapped up the civil wars, and during his 8 years as Sultan, his centralizing reforms, the putting down of the Bedreddin revolt, reorganizing Rumelia, and streamlining the overall mastery of the tax collection system, had meant that the bones of an economic miracle, think the rebound of Germany and Japan after the Second World Wars, was in place. All that was needed was a few years of calm, and the cities, towns, and trade networks could flourish, come to life, and provide Murad with a steady stream of income and all the other benefits of a booming economy. The Ottoman dynasty had awarded high titles and positions to efficient individuals who organized every town, village, port, and city under Ottoman control, so that no individual went without a job to do, and a job that could easily translate into military service should the muster sound, and jobs that all worked together to either increase trade, and thereby the tax base, or bolster the military. Medical, industrial-based, needed to put armor, horses, logistics, and ammunition, everything that was needed to equip the military. On top of this, the empire was becoming a big place, with an estimated population, if we count territories directly under the Sultan's thumb, we're looking at some 3 to 5 million, depending on how you count the numbers. Compare this to the very large, geographically speaking, yet politically fractured Holy Roman Empire that had a population at this time of some 10 million. Fourth and last was the political and religious clout that the institution of Sultanate under the House of Ottoman was attracting. Indeed, Murad himself was becoming someone to watch, you might say, in the wider Islamic world. Before the Mamluks of Egypt, they were kind of the boss in the Islamic world. Now, the Ottomans were on the rise. Before Sultan Mehmed I, if you had pulled up a who's who of the Islamic world, the Ottomans barely registered. Sure, the Khan, and then later styled Shah of Persia, might say that the Ottomans were good soldiers and had given the Byzantines a good beating, but they were basically nobodies. I mean, who were these guys? They were horse plunderers. Indeed, the idea that the Ottomans were one step above horse thieves would play a huge factor in later Ottoman Persian, or as it would later morph into Safavid. The Mamluks never saw the Ottomans as truly legitimate, and neither did the Safavids. However, Sultan Murad II's reign, everyone had to take a second look at this, because it looked like God was smiling upon the Ottomans. This idea that God was pouring out his blessings on a person or people was prominent back then in both Christian and Islamic circles. What is a sign that Allah was blessing thus? Well, look for these. A stunning and game-changing comeback from the brink of disaster? I think we can go ahead and check the Ottoman Civil War period. Military victory against all odds, check. Mystics and great teachers seemingly struck by the muse as they would espouse religious and political ideology that gave these leaders worldly power. So, the Ottomans, and thereby Murad, were rapidly becoming top contenders in the wider Islamic world. This meant marriage alliances with super powerhouses in the Middle East, legitimacy, respect, and resources. So, circling back, let's return to Murad II, seated as he was in Bursa in 1421, with everything I've just talked about running through his head. Murad decided his first course of action was to try and do something about the Anatolian Beys. It was always best to go down and teach them some lessons, than wait until his army was tied up in Europe. Karmenid was too big of a fish to fry at this point for Murad, especially because it was further east. So instead, he decided to send a message to every Beylik that wasn't Karmenid. In 1425, he went for four low-hanging fruits to march in there and do some good old-fashioned gloves-off annexing. The lucky Anatolian Beylik winners were Anadid, Germaniadid, Mentiesh, and Taki. If you look at a map, you'd find these four Beyliks sandwiched in the southern part of modern-day Turkey. For a size comparison, these areas could all fit into the state of Virginia if you pulled up a map of the United States. These areas had been directly annexed by Murad I and then Bayezid later. However, after the Ottoman defeat by Tamerlane, they had become semi-independent. Murad dispatched some of his close officers to Ed Rine to start building up an army there because he knew there would be trouble in Europe. He then sent word for his janissaries and cavalry to assemble in Bursa. He marched down from Bursa and started first with Anadid and successfully invaded and captured the bay of that territory. Murad put the man to death, but it is said that he spared his family. Then, the Sultan took an eraser and pen, pulled up a map of the Ottoman Empire, and erased the broken lines around the province he had just annexed that formally said nominal Ottoman territory, and colored it in with a deep red. And there, the province was now officially a part of the empire. This annexation of Anadid in 1425 marked a policy change for the Ottoman Empire. Previous Ottoman expansion into Anatolia had seen them make concessions, grant semi-autonomy, and cut 11th-hour deals with old Turkic families. This resulted in the social and political structures of Ottoman Anatolia not really different from when the Ottomans first arrived. This or that Beylik would, quote, join the empire. But really, it was more of an agreement to hang out with the Ottomans for the good times, and when the bad times were a-coming, they would maximize their, quote, semi-independent status and leave the House of Osman in the lurch. Now, contrast this sharply with Ottoman policy as they expanded into Europe, where entire kingdoms, dukedoms, fiefdoms, various medieval entities, along with their complex systems involving political, religious, societal, all these organizations would be swept away, making room for the new Ottoman order. And now that Anadid had forcibly been invaded, annexed, and I'm sorry about my mispronunciation, I just want to throw that out there, but there's like three different versions of how this is spelled and two different versions on how to pronounce it, so my apologies. But the aforesaid province was annexed, and its social and familial institutions were crushed, Murad II signaled to the rest of the Beys that it was time to either get on board with the Ottomans now or face a humiliating battle in the future, one of which they were going to lose. Either way, the new Ottoman social and political order was a-coming, like it or not. Sultan Bayezid had attempted something like this during his reign, before the disastrous defeat at the Battle of Ankara, and we covered his bloody campaigns in Episode 10, Part 2, A Crusade Dies at Nicopolis. However, Bayezid never had time to consolidate his holdings, and more importantly, the leaders of these Beys had simply fled or cut last-minute deals that allowed them to simply wait Bayezid out. I'm not going to go through a 5-episode casting of Murad's campaigns to bring the Beyliks into the empire, the 4 remaining ones, that is. Let's just suffice it to say that by the end of 1427, the Beyliks just mentioned were now fully 100% annexed into Ottoman territory. The year was now 1428. The immediate threat of the Turkish Beys had been contained. The Karmanids were still out there, doing who knows what, but they were sufficiently far away that the Ottomans didn't think they needed to really worry about them. Not yet, anyway. Murad II decided, while he was still having his army and administrative structure rebuilt in Rumelia, that the time had now come to secure the approaches to Gallipoli. The city of Constantinople was becoming isolated for sure, but there were worries that a sufficiently strong naval force that set out from the Greek city of Thessalonica could force the channel entrance and thereby jeopardize the Ottoman monopoly of the Dardanelles. The city of Thessalonica had originally been captured by Bayezid, and it sat on a strategically important peninsula that was vital to trade for both the Ottomans and the Venetians. After Bayezid's defeat, the city of Thessalonica threw off the Ottoman garrison and joined the legions of cities that passed from Ottoman hands into their enemies. So, in 1430, Sultan Murad II decided that a good small-scale campaign to besiege and capture Thessalonica was in order. If he moved fast enough, the Christian powers wouldn't be able to stop him. His men could get some really good practice on siege warfare, for when, you know, the real showdown with Constantinople, which was bound to happen one day or another. And the Ottoman position in the seas would be strengthened. Events, as we shall see, quickly played out in ways far removed from the limited campaign Murad foresaw, because when he begun the siege, the Sultan had no idea that years later it would lead directly to what history has called the Crusade of Varna, and perhaps one of the Ottomans' greatest triumphs. I'm not going to go into very much detail about the fall of Thessalonica, but I can assure you of this. The source material on the fall of this great city is vast, and by vast, I mean there are mountains of it. I'm just going to say that as soon as it fell, it began to spur the European powers to start talking about another crusade. At the close of 1430, after a brutal month-long siege in which most of the inhabitants were starved to death, Sultan Murad marched in with his army and took control of the city. Looking around himself, he watched as the Venetians evacuated their garrison and most of the Christian forces pulled out of the Greek peninsula altogether. With the fall of Thessalonica, Murad decided to exploit the weaknesses in the Greek peninsula, and he successfully added yet more territory to the Ottoman Empire. The city of Lani fell to the south, under the leadership of a guy named Ed Karol II Ricardo, and he also surrendered most of the southern portion of Epirus. With the vacuum of resistance, Ottoman irregular forces, settlers, immigrants, and soldiers of fortune flooded into the Greek peninsula from Rumelia and Anatolia. Akinchi warriors, Ghazis, and a ton of men who were just looking to make a name for themselves. Carried with them on their back was a whole new religious order, involving scholars, teachers, leaders, to shore up Ottoman power. With the world turning upside down in Greece, Venice moved fast to seize a port city here and there, and a few islands to help safeguard her trade. The city of Thessalonica would remain in Ottoman hands all the way up till 1912, when it was captured by the Kingdom of Greece during the First Balkan War. Thus it was that Sultan Murad II basically added the whole of contemporary Greece into the empire. Although irritated with the Venetians, there was little the Ottomans could do in the face of their opponents, taking the towns, imports, and small islands. Murad never secured the naval primacy he sought. His future successors would have to be content with Christian mastery of the Eastern Mediterranean for some time to come. Pulling up his maps, Murad brooded during a heavy rainstorm one day in Edirne. Where, oh where, to strike next? On the one hand, the Sultan wanted to bring all the former vassals of the empire, including Serbia, slices of Albania, and Wallachia, back under Ottoman control. However, Hungary had moved troops into Transylvania. Venice, Rome, and contingents of Byzantines had moved themselves quickly to fortify parts of Serbia and most of the mountainous terrain of Albania against Ottoman expansion. In 1432, Sultan Murad set up his headquarters in northern Bulgaria. From there he kept his contingents of Janissaries and other full-time troops still down at Edirne, training and gathering supplies. In the meantime, he decided it was time to punish his wayward vassals with raids by the dreaded Akinci, of which you can hear more about in extra episode number 3, just after episode 16 on the regular show, and any other Islamic soldier of fortune who possessed a penchant for cruelty. Into Wallachia they flooded, and up and down the Danube River they poured into Serbia. As for Albania, the Sultan marched portions of his more disciplined Sapahi cavalry into the country, where they would wage a brutal war against Venetian regulars and Albanian irregulars who had fled to the mountains. At this point, and I hate to break the narrative up like this, but I'd like to pause and take a very brief moment to offer a character profile, that of Princess Mara Brankovic. As Murad II pushed his way into Serbia, the Serbian ruler, Durad Brankovic, was panicking. Because he was viewed with suspicion by his fellow Christian powers in the West, due to concessions made to the Ottomans in the past, at some point, he felt that it would be very wise to throw his weight fully into the Ottoman camp. In 1433, with the Ottomans campaigning in Europe once more and taking fort town after fort town in Serbia, Durad sent word to the Sultan that he would fully fall into line and offered tribute as well as the hand of his daughter, Princess Mara, in order to secure an alliance. I would like to note, this is an important event in Ottoman history because Princess Mara would come to have an oversized role in events in the Ottoman Empire moving forward. Born in 1416, she grew up in very uncertain times. Ever under the threat of Ottoman invasion from the south, Hungarian incursions from the north, her family moved around a whole lot, from one little fort to another. But during this time, she would grow up and learn to speak Greek, Latin, French, and Hungarian, and by all accounts was extremely intelligent and ambitious. Eventually, married to the Serbian's daughter in 1433, Murad II finally marched to pacify both Serbia and Wallachia. Fighting continued in Albania, but things were now finally looking up for the Ottomans. The Christian powers had been put on notice that the Ottomans were back, so to speak. However, the West was preparing a surprise for the Ottomans themselves, what we would later call the Crusade of Varna. thank you so much for stopping by. The research for Varna is taking up lots of my time, and I'm not entirely sure when we will get to the actual crusade, but it should be in the next two or so episodes. Once we cover Varna, we will start laying the groundwork for the fall of Constantinople. Once we pass the year 1453, it's going to be a goalpost to finally make it to the reign of Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. But don't worry, this podcast isn't going to end anytime soon. We still have a whole lot of centuries left. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd invite you to leave me a review on Apple Podcast. More importantly, share this show with a friend. I have a lot of exciting things coming up for this show. For one, I will be starting a website. I'm planning on calling it Shadow of the Ottomans, where it's going to be a central hub because, as you know by now, there is a podcast that's available on Apple and Spotify, as well as Amazon. There is also a YouTube channel and an Instagram. So what this website is going to allow me to do is centralize everything into one location. Murad II would be proud. And another thing, and this is going to be further on down the line, I'm going to start producing a weekly newsletter. Yep, a newsletter. It is going to have lessons from history concerning the Ottomans and other great content that is actually going to be able to help you in your everyday life. Lessons from Oran, the great strategic sultan. Lessons on perseverance from Mehmed II. Lessons on disciplining yourself, on organizing, on logistics. All of that is going to be wrapped up in the newsletter. I am really, really looking forward to the future of this show. I will be here, I will be sticking around, and I hope that you will too. Again, if you appreciate this show, please share it with a friend. And also, I would love to hear from you. You can always shoot me an email. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.